I've got pieces of propaganda here that you can have later on, if you like.
Thank you for suffering through with me at a time. I'm going to talk on this business of the use of animals in research, testing, and education. And I want to cover something about the situation about animal use. What I'd like to think is some factual data. And then consider this business of the ethics of animal use as is discussed and brought forth by the animal advocates, as a matter of fact, and to bring about this, or to draw up a case against the animal rights movement, and then a possible role for Christians. I think we should thank Bill Cliff for setting forth the Christian position and the biblical basis for that. And it relieves me of trying to tread over that ground. I think the thing is that there is quite a bit of literature on the practical benefits of the use of animals, the fruits of research and so on. And maybe I don't need to do this, but I'm going to do it anyways. Just very quickly, there are several books on this, and it's really quite dramatic what has taken place in the past years. Treatment of infections, there's a huge host of different kinds of diseases that are at one point were devastating. Now we don't fear polio, rheumatic fever, smallpox, they eliminated, I think it's officially eliminated, syphilis, typhoid, you know, magic bullet. There are these protozoan diseases, and malaria can be controlled, although there are some problems with that. But there are many kinds of things here. All these drugs, I think, I'm not sure what the actual statistic is now, but most of the drugs that are used today are the fruits of animal research. And I would say, well, maybe 90% of all those things have been just developed just within the last few decades. The anti-cancer campaign is going on, even though we fear cancer a lot. The 5-year survival rate has gone up tremendously because of the efforts in cancer research, using enormous numbers of animals, as a matter of fact. Hormone therapy, nutritional experimentation using animals, prosthetic devices, all these, you know, artificial hips and knee joints and this and that and the other, all developed using animals. It wouldn't have been possible. Inhalation therapy. You know, so if you talk in terms of the practicalities, the benefits are virtually unlimited in terms of all the one thing, because of all these future lives that are going to be saved or their life condition ameliorated. And here's a little graph that I got out of William Patton's book, Men and Mice, or Mice and Men, I can't remember which one it was. But here it's the survival rates, or the death rates rather, death rates per 100,000 births as a function of the year, starting 1860 over here, down to about the 1960. And when salpa was introduced, all maternal deaths went zoom down, penicillin zoomed down further, the death rates are way down just because of the development of these antibiotics. And these were, of course, then tested and made possible to use in humans because of prior work with animals. Well, what animals are actually used? Well, you know, the way the animal activists talk, you'd think it was always your pet dog that somebody stole off the street and have tortured in the lab. Well, it turns out almost the greater majority are rodents, rats, mice, hamsters, and guinea pigs have been specially bred in these breeding laboratories for research purposes. Rabbits, salts are the next group, and there are a few dogs and cats. There are larger farm animals, and then the non-human primates are the fewest of all. They, of course, they attract a lot of attention, though. And the use and teaching, these are all estimates here, I'm afraid, but they're the best estimates would say most animals are used for research, the toxicity testing, that is to make sure that the things that we eat and the cosmetics and whatever we apply to our skin, drugs and so on, are safe to use. Now that's the real problem about toxicity testing, because the chemical industry produces enormous numbers of new chemicals every year, and the testing procedure is an extremely expensive business to be able to say that you've got something at quote safe level. Nothing is safe though. You know, it's a matter of how much we're willing to pay to deal with the to ensure so-called a given level of safety. Drug development is the other big area. Other uses, it escapes from what the other uses are. Anyways, most, as I said, are the sources here, most are purebred animals, are purpose-bred animals. Some animals are pond animals, some primates are wild-caught, the others are raised in colonies. Most, I think, are being raised in colonies that are being used because of various nations that do have primates protect them. Pound animals, you have to realize there are 10 to 20 million cats and dogs that are euthanized every year. It's a serious problem in the cities, and costs, well, a few years ago the estimate was $500 million a year. It's probably a lot more than that now. 40 to 80% of the animals in the pounds have been turned in by the owner. And the animals are kept on the average 3 days to 2 weeks, and then they're euthanized. Now, a number of states have pound seizure laws in which these pounds are authorized or required to turn them over to medical research institutes for use in research. At the costs that vary something like $5 to $55. Now what happens is, of course, the animals have to be held in the animal care facility within the institution for a period of time for conditioning and so on before they can be used for research purposes. But that's a lot less expensive than purebred colonies of dogs, say, for example, have to be raised through generations in order to maintain animals. Now, what's happened is that the humane societies have made the National Humane Society, I'm not sure if I have the correct name, there are so many different kinds of organizations that have all sorts of names that sort of sound the same, but the main National Humane Society has made their priority to eliminate the use of pond animals by working at the state level to get the various states to repeal their pound seizure laws and make it illegal to use pound animals in research. That means that the animals that are turned over to the pound and every year are simply killed. Not even used for dog food, which is happening too. But the effect of it is to increase the cost of doing research using these pound animal sources it's estimated about five times. In Massachusetts, it's been successful. And pound animals in Massachusetts are not used. You cannot import animals from pounds from other states. In fact, I think it's illegal to import animals purely for research. In Massachusetts, you have to breed them right there. And the effect has been to reduce numbers of animals used in teaching research.
it doesn't, in fact, alter the number of animals that are killed. In fact, in some senses, there's an increase in the number of animals killed because you have to raise new animals to use them in research. All of this agitation, though, resulted, as Bill pointed out, in federal regulations, more stringent regulations for use of animals for research. And the PL 544 there has been just newly instituted, where there is a mandate by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Health and Human Services, to require institutions to upgrade their care and maintenance, the housing, the space requirements, the air handling, for example. The air has to be, in any animal care facility, has to be completely changed 10 to 15 times per hour. It's a huge amount of air. And that has to be filtered air and so on. And the exhaust air has to be, exhausted out of the top of the building. We have our animal facilities in the basement, and it has to go up to the sixth floor to be blown up. We have to have very complicated systems for doing that. Food and water requirements are very stringent. The environment can't have... pardon?
It's better than some of the dorms in our
institution. You're right. The floors have to be seamless, epoxy, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, it's really incredible. You can't have wood in there. You can't use brooms. You know, the bristles in the broom can collect germs and so on. You can't use those. It's very, very stringent. The requirements are extremely stringent. You have to have a veterinarian taking care of the animals. You have to have a separation of species so that you cannot have rats and rabbits in the same room. You have to have special facilities for keeping them separate. Experimentation, well, the each institution had to make an assurance statement on animal welfare. Each institution must have this committee called the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, which includes at least one member from outside of the biomedical establishment. All these experimental procedures have to be very carefully laid out. The use of anesthesia and analgesia is specified, and the modes of euthanasia are specified also. And these are being, in fact, we're having an argument about that because during the French Revolution, Dr. Guillotin invented his instrument for painless death. Now it's considered to be too painful because somebody back in 67, somebody put electrodes on a rat brain, on a skull, and looked for EEG records after the moment of severing the head, and he claimed that there were some activity for about 13 or 14 seconds after the severing the head. Well, he said, you can get around this requirement by dropping the head into liquid nitrogen, and that'd be okay. That's a really ridiculous solution because, liquid nitrogen is not going to affect that head in 13 seconds.
No way.
our chemistry professor likes to give these little demonstrations of these things
in the liquid nitrogen and so on. Some people will even drink it,
Just to show that
it's gargle.
Yeah, right. And, anyways, I looked into that too. There are many examples from our clinical, you might say, illustrations of the effect of severing the cord the accounts from World War II, World War I actually, and I can find them from World War II,
of soldiers who, by gunshot wounds, had their cord severed. And many of them report absolutely no pain. They didn't feel any pain because of the spinal shock, I think. They remained conscious throughout the whole ordeal and were not in pain. So I can't see that has any effect. But nonetheless, you see, the emotionalism of this has promulgated these kinds of regulations. Now, animal welfare policy, that is, be treated humanely, no unnecessary pain. Experiments have to be designed to answer worthwhile, meaningful questions, et cetera. These are all the kinds of things that are being required. Smallest number of animals needed are used to obtain the results, explicit reasons for using a particular species, no practical alternatives. You mentioned Gary Ellis's report from the OTA on alternatives to animal use. Well, that's supposed to be being done. And then the personnel, of course, you know, these are all relatively reasonable things and are being done. And I think the motto is that good care is equal to good science. And I think that this is being carried out through the agency of this Animal Care and Use Committee, and they need a lot of help. I think the thing that might be most interesting to you folks here, as we think about this, is Okay, here we are. The animal movement spectrum includes people who have two kinds of positions. One is to say that animals are not morally equivalent to humans, or the group that says animals are morally equivalent to man, to humans. And when we take the first position, animals are not morally equivalent, that's more of the traditional position. It's the animal welfare type position, where you say then that the moral principle is that animals are legitimate objects of moral concern to man, but of a secondary status to humans. And this is, I think, the traditional position is consistent with the Christian tradition from the Bible, for example. And on the other hand, the ethical imperative is that man has a duty to animals based on this principle that animals are in fact legitimate objects of moral concern. Now, man may use animals for humane purposes, and the effect of this situation is to say that animals deserve humane treatment. Now, on the other hand, when we say that animals are morally equivalent to man, there are a couple of positions. There's sort of a utilitarian position that goes on the basis of talking about how these creatures are sentient and so on, and they have therefore equal moral status. And that animal suffering therefore has to be weighed against human benefit for each projected use, that then there must be some sort of unequivocal human benefit with minimal animal suffering. Now, the problem is, it's hard to say balance human benefit versus animal suffering, because you don't know, for example, you know, what the suffering is, and so on and so on. It's a little vague. But the effect is, and this is the call of the animal movement, is a drastic reduction in use of animals in research. The third position is the most extreme, the animal rights position. They would say that there are cognitive capacities in the animals have cognitive capacities, that is, they can think, and there's some elementary or rudimentary reasoning capacities there. They have plans, they have little programs of what they want to do. This entitles animals to rights no less than humans, such as defective humans, you know, who are retarded or whatever, who may be able to function, or at least maybe there are some animals that can function better than certain kinds of humans. And so therefore, you have to maintain the rights of the animals against unwanted intrusion by humans. And so therefore, there's no justification for use of animals by man.
And so the final effect, the imperative is to cease all use of that. And that's the most extreme position. And the whole business of the rights, the animal rights position, is really pretty terrible. I don't want to have to go through the whole business, but the whole question of what moral principle brings this about and so on is extremely, fragile, although the animal rights people don't think so, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over that sort of stuff. Just go and say what the case against the animal movement is. It's basically misanthropic. It's against man. If the anti-vivisectionists had their say back then, at the turn of the century and before,